Ryder had spread a black tarpaulin over the ibis's white superstructure and coated her hull above the waterline with black river mud. Using long bamboo poles, they punted her quietly down the shallow canal to the open river. Under her camouflage, she blended so well into the darkness that even in the brilliant starlight, she was almost invisible from any distance over 100 yards. As she slid into the main current of the river, and the long poles could no longer find the bottom, Ryder rang down to Jock in the engine room for half a head. He turned upriver and cruised eastwards along the Blue Nile. He was deliberately avoiding the main branch of the White Nile because the Dervish artillery batteries were all concentrated on the northern approaches. It was plain that by this time they were expecting the arrival of the British gunboats from that direction. However, in making these dispositions, they had left the other branches of the river to the east and south unguarded. Until the Dervish realized this mistake, the intrepid Ibis had the run of thousands of miles of river. All the dhows coming down the Blue Nile would be Abyssinians. Like Ryder, they were just honest, hard-working traders, selling their grain to the highest bidders. Of course, it was to be regretted that their main customer was the Mahdi. Ryder angled the darkened Ibis across the river. For all the obvious reasons, the captains of the grain dhows were keeping closely to the bank furthest from Khartoum. Ryder and Bakshit stared ahead, watching for the first flash of canvas or the shine of starlight on one of the reed-matting lateen sails. Ryder's lungs ached with the craving for a good cigar, but his stock was dwindling. "Abstinence makes the heart grow fonder," he thought sadly. "I might end up smoking black Turkish tobacco in a hookah. How have the mighty descended in the world?" Bakshi touched his arm. "The first little fish swims into our net," he murmured. Ryder watched the other vessel materializing on the dark waters and muttered regretfully. "Small fishing boat, riding high in the water, no cargo on board. We will let her go." He spun the wheel and sheered away from her. There was a faint hail from the smaller vessel. "In God's name, what ship are you?" Bakshit called back. "Go in peace, with blessings of Allah upon you." They cruised on. As they rounded the first wide bend of the river, 2 miles above the city, another hull seemed to spring miraculously out of the night. They were closing so rapidly that Ryder had only seconds to make his decision. It was a large dhow, broad-beamed and low in the water. She had only a foot of freeboard. Her bow wave creamed back in the starlight, almost slopping over her bulwarks. "Heavy with cargo," Ryder said with quiet satisfaction. "This one is for us." He swung it sharply towards the prize, and as they closed there was a cry of alarm from the man at her helm. As the steel hull made heavy contact with the dhow's timber side, the 3 heavy grappling hooks shot from the Ibis and clattered onto her deck. They bit and held the dhow's bulwarks, locking the 2 vessels together. With a burst of power and hard left rudder, Ryder forced the dhow's bows to slew across the current, spilling the wind out of her sail so that she wallowed helplessly. Then his men swarmed over the rail. Before they realized what was happening, the crew of the dhow were trussed up securely. Ryder jumped down onto the deck just as the captain came up from his stern cabin. Ryder recognized him immediately. "Ras Hailu," he exclaimed, then greeted him in Amharic. "I see you are in good health." The Abyssinian started with shock, then recognized Ryder. "Al-Sakawi, you have turned pirate." "I am no pirate, but you have been dealing with one such. I hear the Mahdi is gouging you on the price of your dara." He took Ras Hailu's arm. "Come aboard my steamer. Let us drink a little coffee and talk business." Jock held the 2 vessels in midstream while they settled down in the Ibis cabin. After a decent exchange of pleasantries, Ryder broached the matter in hand. "How is it that you, a devout Christian and a prince of the house of Menelik, can deal with a fanatic who is conducting a jihad against your church and your countrymen?"
"I am covered with shame," Ras Hailu confessed. "But Christian or Muslim, money is still money and a prophet is still a prophet."
"What price is the wicked Mahdi paying you?"
Ras Hailu looked pained, but his eyes were shrewd in the lamplight. 8 shillings a sack, delivered at Omdurman."
"Christian to Christian and friend to old friend. What would you charge me if I paid in silver Maria Theresa's.
They both enjoyed the trading, for it was in their blood, but time was too short to savour it. Dawn was only hours away. They struck a bargain at 9 shillings, which left both men pleased. Jock towed the dhow into a quiet bay off the main river, known as the Lagoon of the Little Fish. Screened by the papyrus reeds, all hands turned out to transship the cargo of Durra to the steamer. It took all day, for the dhow was fully laden. As darkness fell, Ryder and Ras Hailu embraced warmly and took leave of each other. The dhow caught the evening breeze and ran up the Blue Nile towards the Abyssinian border. Ryder took the Ibis downriver to Khartoum. She was so deeply laden that they had to tow her from the bank of the canal to her mooring at the rear of the compound. As soon as the curfew ended, Ryder sent Bakshit with a message to General Gordon. Within the hour, the general had arrived on the canal bank. He was accompanied by 100 Egyptian troops and quickly set up a chain of men to unload the sacks of Durra. The work went swiftly, and Ryder stood by, counting each one and making notations in his little red book. "By my calculations, General, this is considerably more than the contracted amount." He cast an eye over the column of figures with the rapidity of a bookkeeper. "Even allowing for 10% underweight in the sacks, it's more in the region of 12 tons than 10. Gordon laughed. A rare sound, for Chinese Gordon was not given to frivolity. "Surely, Mr. Courtney, you are not suggesting that I should return the excess to the Mahdi, are you?" "No, sir. I am suggesting that I am entitled to recompense for the overflow," Ryder replied. Gordon stopped laughing. "There must be some limit to your avarice, sir." "I have rendered unto Caesar," Gordon frowned at the biblical reference. But Ryder went on unperturbed. "And now I would like to keep a ton of the Durra for my own use. My compound was pillaged by the rioters. My own people are as close to starvation as any in the city. I have a duty to provide for them, as if they were my family. That does not add up to avarice in my book." They bargained shrewdly. At last Gordon threw up his hands. "Oh, very well, then. Keep 200 sacks for yourself and be thankful for my generosity. You can come up to the fort to collect your Judas shekels." He stamped away towards the arsenal. He wanted to see his precious grain safely behind the walls. But there was another consideration behind his abrupt departure. He did not want Ryder Courtney to see the softening of his expression or the shadow of a smile in his eyes. What a pity to lose a young rascal like that. We should have had him in the army. I could have made him into a first-rate officer. But it's too late now. He is spoilt by the lure of mammon. The train of his thoughts led him on, and he thought of another likely lad. As he reached the gates of the arsenal, he paused and looked towards the north. Ballantyne has been gone 15 days already. Surely by this time he must have reached Stuart's encampment at the wells of Gakdul and given him my message. I know in my heart that God will not allow all my efforts to come to naught. Dear Lord, grant me the strength to hold out just a little longer. But he was tired to the marrow of his bones.